first and foremost, I'd like to welcome everyone this morning to our 2023 annual meeting and thank everyone for coming today. This is the first in-person meeting we've had in a couple of years due to COVID and other restrictions, so it's good to be back with some personal contact with everyone. To begin, as a courtesy, we'd ask that everyone turn off their electronic devices. Before we get started, I'd like to take a few moments to introduce the other trustees. To my immediate left is Wes Reitman. And down on the front row are both Arthur Resnick and Sheldon Espen, the co-founders of Romspen. You can stand up.
Yeah, don't spill your coffee.
The format for today's meeting will be to first proceed with the formal part of the meeting, following which I will ask Derek Jenkin and Wes Reitman to review the results for 2022, outline the first quarter of 2023's performance, and provide some insights into future performance and discuss current issues and opportunities. Following that, we will take questions from the audience. Before starting, I need to caveat what we'll discuss today with the obligatory safe harbor statement, which is here, to protect both the fund and everyone. So I'll just pause for 10 seconds to give people an opportunity, maybe more than 10 seconds, it's kind of long, to read it and just get familiar with it. Although most of you who've been here before have seen this. The annual meeting of the unit holders of Romspen Mortgage Investment Fund will now come to order. I will be presiding as chairman over the formal business of the meeting. And with the consent of the meeting, Wes Reitman, a trustee of the fund, will act as secretary of the meeting. In order to make the best use of our time this morning, I will be asking the secretary to read the proposed resolutions, and I will be asking certain unit holders to move the resolutions which we will be considering and which are set out in the notice of meeting. They will be called on at the appropriate time. With the consent of the meeting, Shirley Tom and Patty Signianis of Computershare Investor Services will act as scrutineers of this meeting. The scrutineers will report on the unit holders present in person and the number of units represented in person and by proxy at the meeting. The scrutineers will also compute the votes cast by ballot on the ballots conducted at this meeting and report to me on these matters. I've asked the scrutineers to deliver their formal report on attendance to the secretary as soon as possible. A notice calling this meeting was emailed or mailed to all unit holders of record of the fund, and the secretary of the meeting has provided me with proof of delivery of such notice. Additional copies of the notice are available at this meeting if anyone would like to see them. Accordingly, with the consent of the meeting, I will dispense with the reading of the notice. While the scrutineers are preparing the report on attendance, I propose that we proceed with the business of the meeting. The financial statements of the fund for the fiscal year ended December 31st, 2022, together with the report of the auditors thereon, has been mailed or emailed to the unit holders of the fund. It is not proposed to ask unit holders to approve the financial statements. However, we would be pleased to deal with any relevant questions concerning the statements during the general question period, which will follow the formal business of this meeting. Copies of the report of the auditors. Oops. We have to go back here. Sorry. Copies of the report of the auditors on the financial statements are available for inspection at the meeting. I will now ask the secretary to read the scrutineer's report on attendance at the meeting.
This is Mike Live. The scrutineer's interim report states that 64 unit holders represented in person, representing 3,775,850 units, 276 unit holders by proxy, representing 59,690,423 units, for a total of 340 total unit holders, and 63,466,273 units, which constitutes a quorum at 22.55%.
Thanks, Wes. I declare that the requisite quorum of unit holders is present and that the meeting is properly constituted for the transaction of business. I will direct the scrutineer's report on attendance to be annexed to the minutes of this meeting. The first item of business is the election of trustees. Pursuant to the Declaration of Trust governing the fund, Romspen Investment Corporation, the fund's mortgage manager, has the right to appoint three trustees of the fund. The mortgage manager has delivered written notice to the fund that its three nominees are Sheldon Esmond, Mark Hilson, and Wesley Reutemann. I now declare the meeting open for nominations for the election of an additional trustee to hold office for the ensuing year or until his or her successor is elected or appointed. I will now ask the secretary to present the ordinary resolution for the meeting's consideration.
The first ordinary resolution to be considered by the unit holders is for the election of Arthur Resnick as a trustee of the fund for the ensuing year or until his successor is elected or appointed. The details of Mr. Resnick's nomination are contained in the trustee information circular.
Are there any further nominations? I declare the nominations closed. As there are no further nominations, will someone move the resolution, please? I have the resolution seconded. Based on the proxies deposited for the meeting, I declare that Arthur Resnick has been elected as a trustee for the fund for the ensuing year or until his successor is elected or appointed. The next item of business is the appointment of the auditors and authorizing the trustees to fix their remuneration for the current year. I will now ask the secretary to present the ordinary resolution for the meeting's consideration.
The ordinary resolution to be considered by the unit holders is the appointment of KPMG LLC as the auditors for the fund for the ensuing year and the authority of the trustees of the fund to fix the remuneration of the auditors.
Will someone move the resolution, please? May I have the resolution seconded, please?
I second.
I now put the resolution to the meeting. All in favor, please signify in the usual manner by raising your right hand. Any opposed? Thank you. Based on the proxies deposited for the meeting, I declare the resolution carried. The appointment of KPMG LLP as the auditors of the fund has been approved, and the trustees of the fund have been authorized to fix their remuneration. The next item of business is the proposed amendment to the fund's declaration of trust. I will now ask the secretary to present the ordinary resolution for the meeting's consideration.
The ordinary resolution to be considered by the unit holders contains amendments to the fund's declaration of trust relating to the prioritization of unit holder redemption payments. The full text of the ordinary resolution was attached to Schedule A to the trustee information circular delivered to unit holders of record in advance of this meeting. Unless there is any objection, we will dispense with the reading of the full text of the ordinary resolution.
Will someone move the resolution, please? Thank you. May I have the resolution seconded, please? Thank you. I now put the resolution to the meeting. All in favor, please signify in the usual manner by raising your right hand. Any opposed? Based on the proxies deposited for the meeting, I declare the resolution carried. Is there any further business? Seeing there is not, that concludes the formal business of the annual meeting of unit holders, and I wish to thank all of you for taking the time to attend today. Final voting results, including the ballot results, will be posted on our website as soon as practicable. Do we have a motion to terminate the meeting, please? Thank you. May I have a seconder, please? Thank you. All those in favor of the motion, please so signify by raising your right hand. Thank you. I declare the motion carried and the meeting terminated. would like to thank everyone who attended today's meeting and those who voted by proxy. I will make a brief presentation, following which Derek Jenkin, a managing partner of the fund's mortgage manager, will review the results for 2022 and its performance through the first quarter of 2023. And Wes Reutemann will talk about some of the fund's issues and opportunities. And after that, we will open it up to questions from everyone here. So to begin with, just a little review of the mandate, strategy, and management for the benefit of everyone who's here. So just a little quick overview. This will be particularly helpful for those that are new investors. Rompspen was established in 1966 and today has over 60 employees. It was founded by both Shelley Espen and Arthur Resnick, who I introduced earlier. We manage over $3 billion today and have had 25 consecutive positive years of return. We serve institutional and retail clients globally, and we are completely focused on commercial real estate lending. Let me take a moment just to introduce some of the Rompspen partners here today, and I will ask each of them to stand briefly as I introduce them. So first, Blake Cassidy. Blake heads up origination in North America. This is a very tedious job of going out and beating the bushes to find a range of opportunities that we will look at to invest in, which is very important. You want to see a big range of things so you can kind of cherry pick what you think are the best. Mary Gianfrido, is Mary here?
No.
She's not here. Anyhow, portfolio administration sounds like a kind of a boring job, but it is incredibly important because it ensures that interest is collected when it's collected, that security is perfected as it needs to be perfected, that renewals are done properly and extensions are done properly, and all of the little tiny things that matter at the end of the day are taken care of. It's a very complex job that has a lot of different elements to it, and Mary is an absolute expert at this, so we're delighted to call her a partner in the firm. Richard Weldon and Peter Olbaum, you can both stand, you're both in the workout group. These two partners work on transactions that end up having trouble, which happens more frequently now than it has in the past, just given the economy and interest rates. Very challenging job, requires a tremendous amount of patience and creativity in order to solve some of these problems, and these guys are both very experienced at it and do a great job. And then finally, Derek Jenkin, right here. Derek heads up investor relations and is responsible for engaging with all of our investors and communicating with them results and issues and dealing with all of the kind of issues and opportunities and problems that investors have. There's a quick snapshot of the trustees who I introduced earlier, so I won't spend any more time on this slide. I move to the mandate, and this really has not changed at all in the history of Rompspen. Our objective is to deliver long-term attractive returns to unit holders that are not correlated with other major asset classes, and strictly adhere to investing in mortgages and the key principles that drive our investment strategy. None of that has changed, since the founding of the firm, and that the track record, I think, speaks to that. We have seen consistent and significant outperformance in most periods that you can measure us against, and with meaningfully less volatility. Today, we are one of the leading Canadian private commercial mortgage lenders. We have total assets under management of just over $3 billion and an annualized 10-year return, net return of 7.3%, which may not sound particularly impressive at this exact moment in time, but recognize that this is over a 10-year period, most of which had very little inflation associated with it. And it was very consistent over that period of time as well. So 7.3% net is actually a very good return given the asset class that we're investing in over a sustained period of time, with every month in that period being positive. We're supported by an expert team, some of them I've just introduced earlier, both in Canada and the United States, which is the geographic area that we invest in, almost equally split between the two countries. And the management and employees of Romspen are the largest non-institutional unit holder with over $100 million of our own capital committed. In terms of risk mitigation, which is very important, I mean, investors like to talk about returns. We like to think about, you know, how do we manage risk to make sure that we don't have problems, because you will always have issues. We perform very rigorous due diligence on all aspects of these loans, from sourcing to lending to administration. 96% of the mortgages in the portfolio are first mortgages, the significance of that being that there's nothing that really gets between us and the actual property we've lent against. Second mortgages, third mortgages, mezzanine positions, equity, all that sort of thing, we don't do. Others do that. That's much higher risk. Being in first position, your return is lower, but at the end of the day, if it doesn't work out, you know you're going to get your hands on the property at the end of the day, and that's the important thing for us. We have a very solid deal flow that brings us a large pool of opportunities to choose from. As I introduced Blake earlier, that's his primary job, is to ensure that that flow of opportunities into our funnel is very wide, so that we see a broad range of opportunities to place our capital in. We don't just invest in these mortgages, we very actively manage them through all stages from the beginning to the end, and that gets particularly complex when things don't work out or the borrower encounters problems with his project. So being very active, very hands-on with all of these mortgages distinguishes us from, typical mortgages. We do not use leverage in our fund, and therefore we can be patient in downturns like the one we're experiencing now. Leverage obviously would enhance returns to our investors, but we have from the outset deliberately chosen not to have leverage in our fund so that we can be patient in solving problems, not amplify our results up and down, and not be beholden to a bank or a third-party lender who wants their money back at an inopportune moment. And finally, the net results that we've generated have been better than equity market index returns over most period of times with significantly less volatility. So that's a kind of a snapshot of the kind of risk mitigation involved in what we do. We follow a very disciplined investment process. We lend, as I said earlier, only on first mortgages. All of the mortgages in the fund are what most people would consider to be unconventional and complex. And the reason for that is that they tend to generate much higher rates of return. These are loans that banks and institutional lenders typically can't and won't do for all kinds of different reasons, regulatory being the primary one. But in doing them, and ensuring that we, you know, underwrite to conservative values around 65% loan-to-value, short-term in nature, and provide downside protection in the way that we structure them with personal guarantees, securing other assets the borrower might have, generates some pretty strong returns. We also lend at interest rates that are significantly higher than what a conventional bank or institution would lend at. Today, typically 10 to 12%, which generates a return, very strong return, but also provides a meaningful buffer in the sense that if we don't collect all the interest, we're still collecting some of it, and other loans are making up for loans where we don't collect all the interest. So that's what's producing the return. And as I've indicated earlier, we don't use leverage, so our returns are not amplified up and down in any particular month or year or quarter. With that, let me turn it over to Derek Jenkin to review 2022, the outlook, and the first quarter of 2023.
Thank you, Mark, and good morning. Building on what Mark has covered, let's turn our focus to how Romspen performed in 2022. As Mark noted, the average 10-year return for Romspen is around 7.2%, So 2022 was a below average year for Rahmspin, only generating a 6.6% net return to investors. However, compared to our benchmarks of the S&P TSX Composite Equity Index and the Short-Term Bond Index, we outperformed those two benchmarks by double-digit returns. So in comparison to the rest of the market, we actually did reasonably well and performed for our investors on a monthly basis every month in 2022, generating, once again, over 322 consecutive positive return months for investors, which means we haven't had a negative month since 1995. Putting that in the context, when you went to Blockbuster back in 1995, you were renting VHS videotapes because DVDs didn't get launched until late 90s. So it's been a while since we've had a negative month. Distributions in 2022 were 61 cents, representing a 6.6 return. The portfolio interest rate softened to 8.8%. This is down from 9.8% the year before. This is due to an increase of non-performing loans within the portfolio. The mortgage portfolio did remain steady at $2.8 billion in size, but the investor capital decreased by 3% to $2.7 billion due to increased redemption activity in the year. Realized losses in 2022 were only $6.4 million, of which we had sufficient reserves to offset this loss. And a $6.4 million loss is in line with typical losses Rahmspin would receive in a given year. Once again, a very small loss compared to the $3.8 billion under management. And overall, at the end of the day, performance was solid, an absolute performance as in line with the fund's mandate. The portfolio remained somewhat stable over the last 3 years, finishing at the end of 2022 with just over $2.8 billion. This is slightly up from 2021, where we finished the year with $2.7. But overall, investors can recognize that the portfolio has remained somewhat stable over the last 3 years. To put that in perspective, though, the last 3 years have been a very difficult period for Rahmspin, first with COVID in 2020, then a short recovery period in 2021, and to finish up 2022 flat is quite an accomplishment based on the conditions we've been facing. As Mark noted, since the beginning of Rahmspin's inception, we have been a low leverage fund. This is by design. It is part of our structure to manage risk by not taking on unnecessary leverage. The leverage that we typically use is used as a short-term cash management tool to help straddle the repayment and funding date mismatches. We finished the end of 22 with a 9% line of credit. This is in line with the fund, and although it may initially appear that our leverage amounts have increased by 900% since 2020, where we finished the year with a 1% line of credit at the end of that year, it is fair to point out that in 2020, we actually had a comparably high line of credit, closer to 10%, during the year, and it was only during the end of 2020 that we started to receive significant repayment from our borrowers and were able to reduce our line of credit significantly. Nonetheless, our low leverage remains below 10%, which is in line with the fund's mandate. The net asset value over the last 3 years has also remained stable. This is a key principle of Rahmspin. We are first charged with protecting our investor principal. And as investors can see, even though our NAV has fluctuated a few pennies each month over the last few years, mostly driven by the circumstances of the market around us today, the NAV of the fund has remained quite consistent, which means at the end of the day, investor capital is being preserved. Distributions and returns over the past 3 years have been a little bit more volatile than in past years. In 2020, we only received 56 cents of distributions. In 2021, where we saw the fund have a good recovery period, investors saw their distributions rise back up to 71 cents, which is more in line with what investors are used to. However, 2022 turned out to be another difficult year for Rahmspin, and as a result, distributions declined. As comparisons, the yield on the fund, or the return of the fund, was 4.4 in 2020 due to a decrease of NAV during that year. In 2021, the NAV remained stable, so the return was the same as the distribution, And in 2022, we saw the NAV slightly increase, which increased the return to 6.6, even though there were 61 cents of distributions. One of the key aspects of Romsman is our diversification. And I will spend a few minutes on this slide because it's very important to point out that when it comes to Romsman, one of the key components of our successful and robust track record is through our diversified portfolio. Romsman has two key characteristics around diversification. First is by geographic diversification. Romsman's investment portfolio has serviced loans from Halifax, Nova Scotia, to Honolulu and Hawaii. We cover essentially the entire map of North America, minus the Caribbean and Mexico. The second component of our diversification is by asset type. There are seven different major classifications of asset types that we lend to, whether condominium, retail, industrial, or residential. The nature of this is that by having this two-way diversification, the goal of Romsman is not to have an overallocation to any one segment or one region. So to put that in context, the condo market in Ontario is much different than the condo market, say, in California or Florida. And by having those diversificating aspects reduces overall risk, even though if an investor sees a higher allocation in one sector, it is then mitigated by the fact that those assets are spread across the entire map. To further diversify the portfolio, we have different loan amounts. We lend out to different size projects. And this, you know, we lend from everything from over $100 million to under $20 million. By having this additional diversification aspect, once again, we reduce the overall risk in the portfolio. The last component is diversifying by maturity. Now, normally, in a normal market, we would have a much more laddered maturity profile. Right now, there's a high concentration in loans that are due in less than a year. In a normal market, you would see a much more balanced approach as part of our mandate to have a good rotation of our loans. This is a bit of a misleader. This was not done by design. A number of borrowers have been not able to repay their loan in a timely fashion. And borrowers that could afford to do so have moved either to extend their loan for maybe a 6 or an additional 12-month period or are operating on a month-to-month basis. What investors should take away from this is that a high percent of our portfolio is geared to repay us as soon as they are able to do so. As Mark pointed out, Romsman has a very, very solid historical track record. Although we compare ourselves to the short-term bond index and the TSX equity index, one can see that when you compare Romsman, it is probably a fair comparison to compare us to the TSX composite index because our returns are more in line with equities than they are debt. And you can see over the 3, 5, and 10-year return markers, Romsman has sort of paced what you would get if you bought into the TSX equity composite. When you get to the 25-year marker, however, what you do start to see is that Romsman outperforms equities over the long term. And what this chart does not point out is the risk-return nature. Romsman was able to generate these returns with near zero volatility in its fund.
The total max volatility the fund has ever seen is 3%. And that's going from a NAV of $10 down to $9.70, which is quite an accomplishment considering our 5 decades of history.
At this point, we'll turn to Q1 of 2023. One of the challenges of Romsman is that, as a mortgage fund, our audits tend to take a long time to complete. That is the nature of our business. So by the time we get our 22 numbers out, we're already quite a way into the following year. So while we're all here, it might be useful to cover off on our 2023 Q1 performance. The market has been very difficult due to a higher interest rate environment. This is expected to continue for the balance of the year. We don't expect interest rates to decline. If anything, they might increase. This has constrained real estate activity across, not only for Romsman, but across Canada and the United States. It has had a real impact on the turnover of properties, both by financing or by selling of properties. This ultimately has had an impact which investors have seen in reduced distributions over the past year. We do expect that many of these areas will be distressed for a while still. However, we do see a great deal of opportunity in the markets today. And once again, that comes down to Rommelsman being able to lend across several different sectors across the entire map of North America. And as the management team continues to work through the processes, the time-tested processes of recovering our assets from borrowers and from dealing with our workouts, we expect that we'll be able to successfully navigate these difficult conditions as we've done before and be able to move forward into better times. Year-over-year comparisons from from Q1 to Q1 2022 to 2023, our NAV has declined by 2 cents. Distributions down notably by 6 cents from 18 cents this time last year to now. And the return of the fund is most notably down from 1.7 from this time last year to current. And that really is the impact that we have, that is really the impact of the increasing interest rate environment that we've seen and the impact it's had on our portfolio. Overall, though, for the trailing last 12 months, Rumson still outperforms our benchmarks. The TSX and S&P, the short-term bond index, have relatively been either flat or down, where Rumson continues, even in these difficult conditions, to generate positive monthly returns for our investors. The outlook for the sector, there is opportunities in every area that we see. Single-family homes, we see a lot of demand here. It is undersupplied. Surprising enough, with the higher interest rates, it is really constraining the supply in the marketplace, and we see lots of opportunity in this space. Multifamily, once again, constrained supply, it's driving demand. We see lots of opportunities in the U.S. Sun Belt. Retail, 2 years ago during COVID, many thought retail would be a thing that no one would want to invest in again. Foot traffic has increased dramatically, and we see opportunities to transform existing spaces for new retail opportunities. Office, with a continued hybrid structure in a post-pandemic world, office, you know, is a weaker area of the marketplace going forward, at least temporarily. And then industrial, increased demand has really made this an area of focus for Rumson. And we look forward to a time when we can take advantage of these opportunities for our investors. With that being said, I now turn the podium over to Wes Roitman to talk about issues and opportunities.
Well, thank you, Derek. That was a good job. It's nice. Derek's our newest partner. And it's nice to have the opportunity to welcome him to the head table for his first live AGM. As usual, my partners ask me to stand up here and do the hard part, right, talk about our challenges. And we have them in spades at the moment. So, you know, I like to put this slide up first because it's a good reminder of what gets us through these times. You know, when you lend money to developers who are dealing with properties that are complicated, large, complex, in transition, suffering from political issues and the like, you have to expect problems. And even in the best of times, we have our fair share of problems. What's different today is that going through a global pandemic, massive surge in construction and other price inflation, the reaction of central banks that's historic and, you know, hiking rates the most they've ever done ever, and an economy that just simply hasn't had the opportunity to adjust to these incredible macro changes, you know, we get problems in spades. And it's really gumming up the works, as you all know, and it's causing most of our problems. But we have to remember, you know, you just get back to the basics. You know, we are built to deal with this. We, as Mark said, you know, we do first mortgages. We're always in first place. We don't spread lend. We don't have banks forcing us to sell. We have a lot of diversification. We have a very disciplined and experienced team to work through it, and we are adding to that team quite a lot, actually, to address the issues that we have. We're never a forced seller. I mean, you know, this is a there's always a situation when you have an investment that's a problem. You either, you know, there's always people, vultures, who will come along and say, you'll bid you a lousy price for it and take it away. We don't accept that. I mean, we treat this like it's our money, and I think a lot of the people in this room wouldn't want us to sell assets in distress. But if you're not going to sell assets in distress, that means you have to take the patience to push through until you get the right circumstances arise so that you can actually monetize the asset at a decent price. And this is why our non-performing loans have historically not turned into losses. Sometimes we get a lower return on them, but it's very rare that we lose money. It becomes a lot of work. We are all of us, I think, lacking in personal time these days, right? It's a lot of work to deal with all of this, but the results are what you've just heard about, right? We have very strong results for a very long period of time. We have very low losses, and this will continue. I mean, this works. We just have to give it the time to work. This chart is a chart of our NPLs, and as I mentioned, they're increasing as a result of, COVID and the issues in the real estate market generally. Today, probably the biggest issue is the lack of finance for real estate developers, buyers. Buyers can't get mortgages. The borrowers can't refinance. So all of this, unless they have fresh capital coming in, it's going to result in a default. They're still building. It's a big number. I get that, but we have to stay the course and fight through it. We put loss reserves in place to help with that. This is a long chart, goes right back to our founding, and it shows the progression of loss reserves in those yellow bars going all the way to 2022. You'll note that we added significant amount to reserves in 2022. The blue bars at the bottom of the chart are our actual realized losses. We've been very stingy at realizing losses. We may have to revisit that perhaps in the future. We have this reserves for a reason, but we're tough about giving up on these things, and so we really show a lot of determination, which is why we have a chart that looks like this. And our loss reserves as a percentage of the assets under administration, that gray line, it's as high as it's ever been, and probably needs to be, given the uncertainty we're in now. Normally at this time in the presentation, I would put up some slides, case studies of loans that we had recently worked out, concluded, and I could tell you all the results, how well we did, on that particular loan. But, the elephant in the room are the large, portfolio of problem loans that we have. And I thought it's more appropriate for this meeting. Let's just talk about the elephant in the room. Let's just talk about the three big loans that are really gumming up the fund. The first one, and just remember, these big loans can turn out just like all those other loans, we had at the other meetings where we talk about them in the past tense. But we're talking about these are live, and in many cases, in fact, in all three cases, there's active litigation ongoing. So we have to be careful about talking about these and what we say. We have to restrict our comments to the public record and things like that. But I want investors to understand what we're dealing with and what it's going to take to resolve some of the issues that we're struggling with right now. And so this first one, which is our biggest loan, and many of you have read about it in the Globe and Mail recently when we applied to appoint E&Y as receiver, and this is a long relationship. We had been lending money to Chris Hinn dating all the way back to 2013. I mean, he had a pretty good role going. We were making out, both of us, quite well. You know, we were doing good in pretty high-rate loans. He was buying and selling properties, usually from large multinationals. There was an article many years ago about him buying a property from Honda on Milner, an old surplus warehouse of theirs on Milner, and then he sold it within 8 months to Ontario Hydro, doubled the money, like $10 or $15 million profit in like a few months. Raised the eyebrows of some of the folks in the Ontario government, of course. But, you know, he was good at finding these things, and it was working well for a while. But as most of these, you know, entrepreneurs tend to do, I mean, he probably pushed it too far. He bought too much. And by 2018, you know, we were starting to see issues arise. You know, he was not selling as much as refinancing. He would go and buy this property, lease it up, fix it up, put in a bank, pay us down. And we organized this as a big kind of revolver, you know, facility, blanket facility on all his properties. So banks, we'd start to fall behind with the banks. He'd come back to us. We'd need to rescue and kind of force the sale of it. And so we went into this forbearance stage with him starting in around 2018. And through that, managed to sell a lot of these assets. And there's three left today. You know, these three have all been subject to, I mean, there's no shortage of interest. They're subject to purchase agreements, at least two or three earlier ones. But they've been challenging, at least for him, to get these closed. That's what's lacking. So we felt we had to take this step, and we had to put him into receivership so we would have some control. And I offered to him, he has a bunch of operating businesses, and I offered that we'll leave the operating businesses out if you just, let's work together on this consent, do the receivership on consent, let's get some professionals involved, let's have this. And he opposed that. Filed a bunch of affidavit material, which resulted in the article in the Globe and all of this. You know, we had our cross-examinations, and the judge issued a ruling. E&Y was appointed a little while ago, and now we're working very hard on closing at least two of the sales for two of the three properties that remain. The Woodbine Mall, which is the biggest one, right? It's a 51-acre redevelopment site across the street from Woodbine Live, the racetrack. Metrolinx is putting a transit line in there. There's a station going right at the corner of Rexdale and Highway 27. It's a very exciting redevelopment site. We haven't done much work on it, but the initial massing studies that we've done show you could probably get as much as 6 million square feet of mixed use on this site. But it's a very complicated thing to turn an indoor mall into a new project. I mean, it's happening all over the world, right? Indoor malls are no longer viable type of building. But this is a good one. You've got airport issues, though. You've got transit issues. You've got tenants, including the Hudson's Bay. So you've got a lot of things that you have to resolve, and developers study these things and getting them comfortable. That they can get over the hump is a challenge. We think we can get there. We have a very committed developer in a conditional deal now, but we'll see. I mean, they want to see stability, right? If you're making a multi-hundred million dollar investment, you don't want to do that in an environment where there's a budget crisis, right? The U.S. is going to default, or, you know, you have, you know, incredible inflation or uncertain interest rate environment. You want stability, and the choppiness of this is has a deadening effect on these transactions and slows them down. And so, you know, that's what we're wrestling with. The other property, and this is an interesting story, is a warehouse on Birchmount in Scarborough. And that property went under contract a few times, and then most recent time it was a a fellow who's in the outdoor furniture business who's going to use the property for his own business. And he tied it up at $85 million, came around Christmas time and waived conditions, negotiating a discount to $71.5 million, putting up $4 million non-refundable, closing in early February. And the closing comes along, and all of a sudden he starts making excuses. Oh, I can't get insurance. And these are not credible excuses. The building's insured and whatever. It turns out, he just didn't have the money. I mean, something happened to his financing. And so he filed a lawsuit. He's trying to, figure out how he's going to avoid losing his $4 million. And, we have the receiver now. In large measure, which will speed that up, because you could spend 3 years litigating over a failed transaction like that, certificates on the title and all. He still says, there's a hearing even going on at this morning, a status hearing on this issue, but he says he wants to close, he just needs his money, he just needs more time. It's the usual type of story. So we are, we're working our way through that, and hopefully we can get Birchmount sold, but it depends on whether he gets his money. And the last property here is Chris owns a strip plaza at the corner of Rexdale and Islington, smaller redevelopment site. The other three corners are all being redeveloped as multi-use. They do multi-use is a buzzword that means the ground floor is retail, and above that it's all residential. That one is only recently on the market. He was trying to hang on to this asset. He's owned it a very long time, and so he's resisted selling this one before all the others. So now it's going to be sold as well. And so with some luck and a little bit of steadiness in the marketplace, hopefully we can get these issues resolved maybe this year or early next year. But, again, depends on how the market treats us. The next one is a very large development, a full city block in Richmond, which is a suburb just south of Metro Vancouver. It's right near the airport. And this is seven towers on top of a three- or four-story podium of retail. And it's a very big project, billion-dollar project at least, to build it all out. And when we first got involved, it was a land loan. We did a $90 million land loan to take out their previous lender and to give them the marketing to get out and sell, because you have to pre-sell to get the construction financing. So they went to market. They had a fantastic marketing. They sold $250 million worth of condos, both the retail and the residential condos, at very good prices, $950 a foot for the residential and maybe $1,200 for the retail. So they went out looking for construction financing, and we were talking about it. It's a very big loan. It was going to take a number of lenders to put this loan together, so we offered to try and organize that loan for them. With a conditional commitment, which we were going to work together on finding, lenders to all chip in and do this. Maybe it would be an A-B structure, whatever, we had to work on it. And this was in the latter part of 2019 that we signed that up, and of course we had until the end of March 2020 to put that together. And in the middle of March, the pandemic was roaring, everything was shutting down. I had to pick up the phone and tell these guys, there's just no way. Nobody's going to do this construction loan at this moment in time. So everything has to be shelved. And it sat there for a while. We didn't want to start and be very aggressive with them given the circumstances. It's not their fault that the pandemic derailed their plans. And we spent a large part just informally forbearing with them. They worked with a big local developer to try and sell, joint venture, the completion of this thing, which kind of, I guess, stalled out, I suppose, because of issues, some infighting among the partners in the group and the various stakeholders in the group, and maybe a little bit of reluctance from that developer given the situation in the, that time in the market. And then they started working with, still are trying to work something out with Kingset to do some money. But it just ground on and on and on until we finally said, okay, enough, guys. We have to insert ourselves a little more forcefully, and we cut a deal to do what they call a super monitor, which is like a receivership, except it's under the CCAA, with Myers Norris Penny, MNP, Bowra, but they got bought, and now it's MNP. And we put the project up for sale. There were some bids, but they were low bids. The concern, and for most of the developers and bidders at the time, was that the development permit gave some benefits that had, you know, lapsed, and they changed rules in Richmond, and now you have to do more affordable housing, you have to do more bigger fees and all that. They were concerned about that. They were concerned about the building permit, which had expired and was reliant on older building codes in BC and everywhere, really. They're always upgrading these building codes. So as a result of that, we said, well, let's go and resolve those threshold issues. So we paused the marketing. We went back to the City of Richmond. We got them to confirm that the development permit will be honored in its original form. We got them to agree to what they're calling 2018 code compliance. So we had to redo the drawings, which is work that's underway, but we had to redo the construction drawings to meet some higher seismic, but not a wholesale change. So this was a big get. And we're working right now to have those drawings and all the engineering and various studies updated so that we can apply for the permit in November. 1st of November, apparently, we have to. So this summer is going to be a busy summer for the guys working on this. And at that point, with those uncertainties resolved, we think it can go back on the market, and perhaps we'll find a developer at that time that's not going to have an excuse to say this is a problem. Along the way, what's happened is, although there was a little bit of pause and restart or whatever, but condos outside of the center of Vancouver and housing generally in Vancouver is seeing pretty much what we're seeing here in Toronto, which is that there's just immense pressure because there's not enough. The folks, the developers that we've been talking to about this recently all say they would terminate those older sales from 2019 that are at $900-something dollars a foot because they think they can get 12 or 11. You know, they can get higher numbers today. And so that's encouraging, but we still have a few months before we can get out there and try and do that. So, you know, that's our plan with this one. And, you know, we may have to hold some paper on this for a little while with the developer if financing conditions don't improve. But it's a solid project, a decent asset, and a solvable problem. We just have to show the patience to get through it. And the last of our big three is this campus in Austin, Texas. And this goes back to a former client of ours in Edmonton who we did business with, a bit of a cowboy, way back. And we made good money with him in the past. We showed him this site. This came up. I can't remember who found it. Something to do with another one of our borrowers, I believe, in the Austin area pointed it out to us. And I referred him to the site. He fell in love with it right away. Big old industrial plant, former Motorola semiconductor factory on 109 acres. Austin is a booming city, as most of you know. And so he bought it. It didn't take long for him to fight with the first partner that he bought it with. They got into a big fight, and we had to come in, fund him to buy out the partner from another partner. We kind of got along with for a while. And you can see these don't know if you can see them. Maybe I can get the arrow on them. But these, they leased, they did some leases, and they these kind of dark blue buildings over here were the were where the tenant was going to go. So we gave them construction loan to fix those buildings, get them ready, and it was a lot of work. And then that tenant kind of bailed at some point. They started fighting again, and it just looked like there was no way he was going to pull this off. So we put a receiver in. The receiver was not particularly effective, and a bunch of the trades petitioned him into an involuntary Chapter 11. And during that process, it was like litigation slugfest. I mean, everybody suing everybody. We fought that through the early part of the pandemic, and our strategy was let's just get the property. So we'll deal with all these claims and bond them off and whatever. So we can get to the property and start working on the property as soon as possible, which was successful. Finally, all that litigation was dismissed by Judge Pittman just a few months ago. But we still have litigation pending in Alberta because the Alberta court's waiting on what happens in Texas. Now we can hopefully later this month resolve the Edmonton part of the litigation. And then the game plan here is to subdivide this site, find the tenants for it. Now that's a lot more challenging in this environment because it's office space, but it is a beautiful campus. You have a lot of natural features. You know, the buildings add a lot of value because you don't have to spend as much to build them brand new. You have a rail line, which you can kind of see in this photo, which is going to be a transit system for Austin at some point. We are very close to Elon Musk's new gigafactory that he's putting in there, as well as his SpaceX facility, as well as his Boring Company facility. So there's a lot of activity in the area, and it's a bit of whale hunting for us because it's a big site. So, you know, the companies that we're targeting are generally very large companies in the tech industry for perhaps a headquarters, large life sciences enterprises that want lab space or, you know, testing or clinical work or whatever. So, you know, whale hunting is... It takes time. You got to get the whale on the hook. We have a few. We'll see. But it's something that Rich is very optimistic about. I think it's just a question of how long will it take before we can hit that hit that key tenant buyer. So I just want to switch to the results of some of that. I mean, those three are, you know, big fraction of our NPLs, and they certainly affect liquidity. But liquidity is also affected by all of the repayments that we normally receive on mortgages, which is largely dependent on conditions generally among banks and other lenders in our space, allowing them to repay the loans. And so, you know, that's been very, very choppy, you know, since the pandemic and all of the ensuing ups and downs. This chart shows it to some degree, but it doesn't show it in tremendous granularity when you look at the month by month or whatever. But, you know, 2019 was the last normal year we had. And if you see it's about $720 million, which is about $60 million a month of mortgages repaying on average, that would be about, what, a quarter of the portfolio, give or take. That would be very normal. If you looked at that going all the way back, perhaps there was a bit of a blurb in 2008 with the crisis in 2009, but like for a decade it was in spitting distance of that type of level, which allowed us to be relatively predictable in terms of our cash. 2020 came along, and although you see 563 doesn't look like that much of a reduction, the first 9 months of that year were probably 120 million, 150 million. We saw hardly anything come in early 2020. I mean, it was it was scaring us a bit. I mean, we were down to like $10 or $15 million a month in mortgage repayments during the heart of the pandemic. And then at the end of the year, we had this surge, which continued right into 2021, which was very liquid. And all that, you know, money flowed in. We paid a lot of redemptions. And you may recall in 2021, we paid, you know, $700 million or whatever redemptions. We paid a fair amount of redemptions continuing into 2022. I mean, this started to ease off a bit towards the end of 2021. And 2022 started out quite promising. I mean, we were expecting, you know, Woodbine would be sold. We were expecting Atmosphere would be sold. And then the inflation took off. The Fed started doing its thing, and everything stopped. So that was a bit of a disappointment. We had, you know, $320 million come in. And this is continuing. I mean, the first quarter, we only saw about $70 million payoff. It's pretty dry out there. Liquidity is very, very tight right now. I mean, this barely allows us to pay the advances on our construction loans, right? We fund, maybe folks don't understand this, but about a third of our book is construction lending. There are high-rises going up in the middle of construction all over the place. And we have to meet those draws monthly. That's kind of the first priority. Because if you stop funding that, you're going to have a half-built building, which is clearly impaired collateral. None of us want that. So the number one priority is that, and that's what we've been focusing on now for the last, you know, 9 months, let's say, since the Fed started and now it's dried up. And so redemptions, you know, are very important to us. You know, honoring these redemptions is a big priority. But yeah, we've got to balance it with you know, what I was just talking about. We, you know, first and foremost, we have to ensure that the projects that we're funding get completed and sold. That'll generate some liquidity. And at times, like we've seen over the last 3 years, I mean, redemption requests, they rise dramatically. I mean, they always seem to rise dramatically at the time when you can meet them, you know, least. You know, that's a bit of a dilemma. You know, I mean, you see it in public markets, you know, because this happens in public markets too, but in public markets, the securities just wind up trading way below book value. I mean, you could look out today at any number of public securities and you'll see that they're trading at 50 and 60 and 70% of book value. And that's because investors are selling them. They're selling them below their fair value just to get money. Our fund doesn't have that kind of a mechanism. I suppose many of the redeemers here, if I offered them, you know, big discounts like that, they wouldn't want to accept them either. So, you know, it's a challenge when you run into these things. And, you know, these have been very stressed markets, a very tough 3 years, and it's ongoing. I mean, we hope that we can find a place and arrive at a place where there's some steadiness and stability. Interest rates at where they are today aren't all that concerning to me. I think, you know, I think it's better than having very low interest rates. I would just like them to steady off, have a few years of peace and calm so that developers and others can make investment decisions without worrying about the next big macro boogeyman that's going to come and, you know, cost you all this money. And so, you know, that's the message I'd like to convey, is that, we must be patient. That's how you get these solid returns. And I'd like to ask for all your patience. It's hard work for us. We're doing everything we can. We know that there are people who need their money. We're a small boat in a big sea, and we have to manage through that.